compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. The number is 888-914-9149. Let's start off with David in Pennsylvania. Good morning, David. Welcome.
Patrick, thank you for taking my call and thank you for what you do. I hopped in my car in the parking lot of the Children's Hospital and just walked out of a meeting asking our leadership to stop, to look into what we're doing for the children.
You're not a patient.
I'm a pediatrician.
Okay. Got it. So what's going on? What caused you to have that reaction to the hospital leadership?
What's happening to my patients and what's happening? I go to the Reddit periodically. Mm-hmm. It breaks my heart, my patients, what they're going through. I've been doing this for 30 years, and it's only in the last 5-6 years that I've been seeing kids with gender dysphoria. And I've got theories and ideas why it's happening. I may be wrong, I may be right, but the children are hurting, the children are in pain, and the adults are not healthy.
The adults are harming them. Walk me through an example. I mean, obviously, patient confidentiality, I'm not asking you to reveal any actual people. But give me an example of when mom and the daughter walk into your office, or dad and the son, or whatever. Can you kind of describe what that's like and what they tell you? And I mean, because I can only guess at what that conversation is like. And you're having those conversations, right?
They're desperate. They're in pain. I listen. Inevitably, I
whack. What do they say?
Well, the children are often sullen and quiet and just sad. The data shows almost all of these children have serious comorbid mental health issues, depression, anxiety, autism, social anxiety. And this won't come as a shock. The parents are shocked that I know it, but somewhere in the conversation I ask, so when did he or she start looking at porn? And it's usually elementary school, 8 to 9 years of age. And they're being sexualized so early. They're losing their innocence. Losing your innocence is a terrible thing to happen.
Yep.
None of us like it when that happens. And before they can, I mean, you can't process that at 13 to 15, and they're having to process it at 8 and 9. Mm-hmm. And then they're confused, they're traumatized. And there's many of them are coming from dysfunctional families, other painful situations. We've all got those.
Do you get the impression, David, that the kids are seeing the porn because their parents are looking at it? Or is it maybe more often that the parents foolishly gave their young children a smartphone long before they were ready for it and they found the porn that way?
It's probably the latter, but in some cases it is the former.
Okay.
Where it's just what the family does. But it's mostly, I mean, I remember my 5-year-old daughter, she's now a teenager, she was on my computer in early days. This was early aughts. And she came to us panicked what popped up on a YouTube video. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh my gosh, my 5-year-old can see this? And we've tried to restrict our daughters, but it's hard. It's hard. But no, the communities that they're getting involved in, I think you see that on the Reddit that you read, the communities that kids are getting involved in, it's terrible what are happening to our children. Terrible. We need to pray and protect our children.
As a physician, David, as a pediatrician, what are you allowed to do, and are there things you're not allowed to do when it comes to counseling these children and their parents?
From an ethical standpoint, I cannot refer them.
To what?
My conscience doesn't. To a clinic that will do a transition.
Good. Okay? Good.
They come to me looking for a referral, and I cannot cooperate with that.
Yeah.
And
but your peers do.
I let
right.
My peers are all afraid. I've yet to talk to a peer who is not concerned, but more silenced. We're afraid.
So would they, out of fear, would fear of retribution or fear of, you know, the wrath of the hospital administration coming down upon them, would they just refer the child and then?
Well, I don't know that the hospital administration would come down. I think the name calling by colleagues, we all want respect from our colleagues.
Sure.
And the name calling, the innuendos, the, you'll quickly be called transphobic when you're really concerned about the welfare of the child sitting in front of you.
Yeah.
And this may not be the best. And I'm sure you know, Finland and Sweden have pulled back and stopped doing this.
Tell me more about that. No.
Okay. In the summer of 20, the Finland Health Ministry pulled back and said, we're not going to transition kids anymore under 18. Unless it's under strict research protocols.
Okay.
And the Karolinska Institute in Sweden in April of this year made the same voluntary decision. When I mentioned this to some people, they go, nobody's doing that. Only little institutions that are rogue. Well, the Karolinska Institute awards the Nobel Prize in Medicine.
Mm-hmm. They have some little standing. They have some prestige.
Yeah, yeah. And these were very liberal countries that have been
transitioning. What prompted this?
Adults for 20, 30 years. Because what prompted it, and this is getting into the weeds, in 2014, the Dutch published a protocol on transitioning youth. Okay? And they've transitioned 55 kids. And the hypothesis was, their hope was that the mental health outcome would be better because transitioning of adults was not improving their mental health outcome. There's no evidence that it does, despite what you'll see in the media. Yeah. So their hope was we'll not only help them, but we'll also, they'll have better cosmetic outcomes. So that 55, they reported it. There's a lot of questions about the methodology and the accuracy of those reports. But because of that, since then, since 2014, the numbers have skyrocketed. Clinics that used to see single-digit, double-digit kids are now seeing thousands of kids, thousands.
What is causing that? Now, this is, I don't want to interrupt your train of thought, but what do you think in your capacity as a physician, David? You're seeing these people. What is the catalyst for this massive increase? Is it TikTok? Is it social media? Is it... You know, how are these kids being turned like this? Where is this coming from?
It's everything has been captured. The media, social media, mainstream media, our schools, not just colleges, but the elementary schools, the middle schools, the internet, access to the internet. They're getting this message over and over and over again. If you are troubled, it very well may be because there's something wrong with you sexually. We've sexualized the kids, as I said earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
So, the corporate world, okay, commercials, everything we're bombarding, the message is loud and clear.
So when these kids walk into your examination room with their parents, are you able to kind of discern from what they tell you where they're getting this? They're getting it from TikTok, or they're getting it from YouTube, or they're getting it from some other source, or is it just... You know that in general, that's where these messages are coming from. Are you hearing anything specific?
Yes. I was very confused the first 3, 4, 5 times I heard this because they all sounded exactly the same. And then I read Abigail Schreier's book and I was like, whoa, they're reading from a script. They're reading from a script. And there are physicians online that will tell kids, there's one in particular, I will not disparage anybody, that says, tell them you're suicidal and you'll get what you want. These kids want to fit in. I think you may not know this. The latest survey, 10% of children identify as non-binary now in high schools. Mm-hmm. The latest survey. So it's a popular movement, just like when I was in high school, it was popular to pierce your ear.
Yeah.
It's a little bit more than that. Just a
little bit more. Wow. Well, David,
a lot more pain.
I'm really glad you called because you're giving us a window into the medical side of things. You know, we see it in the culture.
It's been capped.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Thank you for what you're doing. Pray for the children.
We will indeed. That's a great reminder, David. Thank you. And we'll pray for you and all the other good physicians out there who are trying to make a difference. I know you probably feel like you're spitting into the wind half the time, but thank you for doing what you're doing. I want to share something kind of related to this. You tell me what you think. This has to do with, of all things, headphones. Headphones. The Irish News has got a fascinating story about how headphone use is sparking a pandemic of loneliness. Now, this is based upon some scientific studies. One study by an audio firm, Jabra, found that UK headphone users wore them for an average of 58 minutes a day, with 38% keeping them on to actively avoid talking to others. The research found that nearly half of those who were surveyed, 47%, wear headphones when they go for a walk. 29% said they did so while traveling in public transport. 15% said they were headphones they used every day for non-work purposes. And that figure goes up to 30% among 16 to 24-year-olds. It said people in the UK were now going on average 5 weeks without talking to someone new. In response, the company, Jabra, has called on people to step away from their headphones for one day to reconnect with others around them. The study has sparked concerns over loneliness and a lack of social interaction, particularly in the wake of lockdown restrictions during the pandemic. 32% of those who were asked said that they were speaking to new people less often than they did before the first lockdown back in March of last year. 20% said they felt significantly less connected to others. Professor Narina Hertz, author of The Lonely Century, said the study showed that, quote, we are in the midst of a crisis of disconnection that the pandemic has significantly amplified. But even before the pandemic struck, this was a lonely century. Ensconced in our digital privacy bubbles, headphones on, heads in our phones, all too often we actively distance ourselves from those around us. The study says, with loneliness damaging not only our mental but our physical health, loneliness is bad for our health, as bad as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. It's essential that we commit to reconnecting to other people. Researchers, the article says, have found that even just a 30-second exchange with a stranger can make you feel significantly less lonely and significantly more connected to those around you. For many of us, one of the spokesmen for this audio company says, for many of us, wearing headphones is part of everyday life, whether for work calls or entertainment, such as listening to music when we're on the move. But from time to time, have a break and channel your focus on the outside world, the real world. One of the things the last 18 months has taught us, they say, is that social interaction in the company of friends means everything. So, you know, as we were talking to the good physician there a moment ago and his frontline dealings with children who think that maybe they are trans, and the parents and the social forces, social media. Cyrus, you and I were talking a little bit about social media during the break. I'd like to get your thoughts on that as a father. But I just want to add this little sidebar in there that, you know, something as mundane as headphones, if this study is an indication, it would suggest that that too can contribute to loneliness. And I would have to think that loneliness must be a big part of the confusion that some of these young people are experiencing. It may not be the only part, but I'm sure it contributes to it. You have kids in school, Cyrus. What are they saying to you when they come home from school?
Well, when there is school, I mean, they just spent a year and a half no school and being isolated and staying on their headphones almost constantly and with their nose in one device into the other. And, and they're in their online learning every day. And so there's 8 hours of staring into a screen there. And then they get off that and they jump right onto a phone or a tablet or a video game system, and it's nonstop screen time, and it's a constant battle.
Do you ever find, I want to hear what you're saying, but I just want to interject, do you ever find that there's that tendency that all of us as parents can fall prey to say, you know what, at least they're quiet, you know, I'm just going to let them ride that wave with the headphones on because at least they're not bugging me, you know, at least they're being quiet and not making a mess. I've been there myself, and you know, that's not a good reaction, I don't think.
No, it's a terrible reaction, and you're absolutely right. And there have definitely been times where where it's like, well, this is fine right now because I need to get this thing done, or I'm working on this project. So at least they're not out getting into trouble. When I was a kid growing up, I had a single mom, and she worked constantly. So I was always home by myself. And video games were a great way to keep me off the streets. Mm-hmm. Now it's almost the opposite, where spending all this time online is kind of like being on the streets.
But a much worse
street. In a much worse street. That's absolutely right. And so it's a battle that I'm losing. I'm not doing a very good job of reining in my kids. And so we have school starting this week, and I'm so glad that it's starting because I can use that. At least there's some time when they're at school where they're not on some kind of a device.
You can disrupt the syndrome.
That's right.
By the way, I'm here to say to everybody, I think Cyrus, from everything I can see, I think Cyrus, you're a great dad. And as I told you, I do believe that your children will thank you gratefully later for being as attentive as you are, and as your wife is too. This world out there, the trans movement and all the other stuff that's going on, I know that you're not directly subject to it, nor am I directly subject to it. I mean, you can see it if you look online. You don't have to look very far. But are your kids bumping into it? And if so, what are they reporting back to you? Or what are you hearing from your kids, even anecdotally, about what they're seeing and picking up on that street that they're on, or with the peers that they know in the neighborhood kind of thing?
I'm starting to see, if you have any kind of a viewpoint that isn't 100% in favor of whatever the 13-year-old kid is feeling, then you're a bad person. Mm-hmm. So if they have a friend that is, they're so little, and they're talking about gay friends, and it's like, you shouldn't be sexualized at all.
Right.
You should be having fun with your friends, and that's it. Mm-hmm. Your sexual preference shouldn't be a part of any of your. Why is that even a part of their conversations at this point?
Yeah, it's like that doctor that we talked to a minute ago was saying, you know, the innocence of these children is being torn from them, and what a horrible thing that is.
Yep.
And it's, you know, I really do believe, I'm sure you agree with me, is that this is. At its essence, this is diabolical, because of course the devil wants children and others to lose their innocence as early as possible. And whatever tools can be used to make that happen, because when you lose your innocence, especially at that young age, then you're even more vulnerable than you were before that. And you're even more vulnerable to being preyed upon, or to be manipulated or exploited, as we're seeing so often.
Yeah, manipulated. That's such a good word, and that's the one I've used with my kids. It's like everything you're watching, the people behind these apps and the phones and the computers, they have years and years of psychological study to specifically manipulate you.
Yeah.
They have people working around the clock to manipulate you to buy the products that they want you to buy and think the way that they want you to think. And so you have to be smarter than that. But they're constantly being bombarded with it. So they get off TikTok, and then they jump on Disney Plus, and the cartoon it's obviously for little kids. The main character is in a gay relationship. They're going from one thing to the other, where it's constantly being reinforced.
Walt Disney is turning over in his grave, you know, at the thought of this, I hope. Well, Cyrus, you know that I think you're doing a great job, but it's all the more reason, it seems to me, especially for parents, to redouble their efforts. This is not the time to slack off. This is not the time to coast. This is the time to push the pedal to the metal and be more attentive and tuned into what your kids are looking at and listening to and how they're being influenced. And when necessary, you know, curb it. Take it away if you need to. Don't give your children smartphones. Do not do that. It's like handing a child a stick of dynamite. And the inevitable consequences will be irreversible down the road. So don't do that. If you've given them a smartphone, take it away. And there'll be some wailing and gnashing of teeth for a time, but that'll pass, and they'll thank you for it later. I have to take a break. We have to take a break. We'll come right back with your phone calls right after this. The number is 888-914-9149. If you have trouble getting that book, Irreversible Damage by Abigail Schreier, I'm told that it is in stock at christianbook.com, another resource for you. I'll be right back. Today's programming sponsored by Solidarity HealthShare. Information on their health plans available at CatholicHealthShare.com. That's CatholicHealthShare.com.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
This was a good choice of music to play, Cyrus, because I guess you knew what topic I was going to next, right?
Unfortunately.
You predicted it. Well, you were right. I mean, I watched Batman and Robin when I was a kid because it was the TV show. What was his name? Adam West, I guess. I forget the name of the
actor. Adam West and Burt Ward.
Right. And the Penguin.
That's the one.
And yeah, I loved that show. That was fun. It was. I didn't understand how campy it was until I was an adult and I saw it with adult eyes. But as a kid, I think all kids loved it. So it's in the news because, as you know, Cyrus, this is Newsweek's take on this. Batman's well-known sidekick Robin has come out as bisexual in the latest issue of Batman Urban Legends. They're just pushing it and pushing it.
This is exactly what we were talking about before the break.
Yeah.
They're bombarded with this narrative.
Yeah, and I know this isn't the first time they've taken a superhero from, what is it, Marvel or DC Comics
both,
or whatever. I know they're different.
Everyone's
ones.
Doing it. Yep. They're all
so
doing
they're
it.
They're not only sexualizing them, but they're turning them into superheroes for that ideology.
Regardless of what the creator wanted. It has nothing to do with who actually created these comics. This is just
they've been hijacked.
They've been hijacked, and it's an agenda. They think this is going to sell comics, I guess.
Well, you know, the thing is, first of all, as you know, there is no Robin. Robin's a character. Robin didn't come out. The people who are making these movies
Good
and books
point.
And things, that this is their ideology. It has nothing to do with Robin. Tim Drake, the third rendition of Robin, is featured in the monthly anthology created by DC Comics. Tim had his light bulb moment in the sixth issue of the series. How interesting.
Oh, good for him.
The sixth commandment. You know, I'm just putting that out there. I wonder if they did that on purpose. Probably not. They probably don't read the Holy Bible. Ever have a light bulb moment? Tim asked in the panel, like something out there in the ether has been taunting you, teasing you, like you know you're supposed to be on the same page as your brain, but not everything made sense. People keep asking me what I want, but I couldn't grasp it. Whatever it was, it always felt just out of reach until now, until right now. And then, Tim Drake, do you want to go on a date with me? Bernard asks, the iconic superhero sidekick. Yeah, Tim replies. I think I want that. It's like a really messed up romance novel involving Robin.
This drives me nuts. They're so uncreative. They can't just make a new character to do this. They have to take something that's been beloved for more than 50 years. This reminded me a great deal of when George Takei, who's a big time
Sulu,
right, from Star Trek. He's a big time LG BTQ plus.
Slow it down.
I don't know.
You can get all the letters, but you have to slow it down.
Oh, I'm too fired up.
LGBTQ
plus. Plus. Yeah.
And we now know from Noah Trevor that the plus stands for the Cuomosexuals out there, I think are going back into the closet after what happened to him.
Yeah. Refer to the first hour of today's show for that reference.
Right.
So a couple years ago, when the new Star Trek movies were coming out, they decided to make Sulu's character gay, and because George Takei is gay,
right?
And
the actor,
even George Takei, was like, I went to look this up because I didn't want to get it wrong. He said, "I'm delighted that there's a gay character in Star Trek. Unfortunately, it's a twisting of Gene Roddenberry's creation, mm-hmm. to which he put in so much thought. I think it's really unfortunate. They are paying tribute to me, not the character Sulu, or to Gene Roddenberry, the man whose vision has carried us through half a century. They need to honor him and create a new character."
You know, I can meet him halfway on this issue. I mean, that's sensible. And at least he has the right instinct to say, why are you messing up what Gene Roddenberry produced? You know, I'm sure he's turning over in his grave for that kind of thing to be going on. But listen, I want to read you again, everybody, the dialogue from this Tim Drake, the third rendition of Robin from DC Comics, when he's talking about his light bulb moment. And as I read this to you, tell me if this doesn't sound to you like a script that is intended for the impressionable 13-year-old girl or 12-year-old boy who is being told by peers and others that maybe they are really trans. They just don't really realize it yet. Now, listen to this and think of it in that sense. Have you ever had a light bulb moment, like something out there in the something out in the ether has been taunting you, teasing you, like you know you're supposed to be on the same page as your brain, but not everything made sense? People keep asking me what I want, but I couldn't grasp it. Whatever it was, it always felt just out of reach until now, until right now. I mean, it's almost like the programming for grooming a child into thinking that he's trans, so to speak. So
exactly. That's exactly right. What 13-year-old isn't questioning the world and having all their hormones are off the charts.
All kinds of feelings.
Yeah, feelings they've never had. They're so confused. Oh, and they're looking for a light bulb moment. And here in this comic book that they've been enjoying since they were little, Robin's having a light bulb moment. Maybe I can have one of those too.
And maybe that's what my light bulb moment is. I want to be a superhero. That's another subtle undertone here. I want to be like that. Remember the Harry Potter craze when that swept through and there was a certain number of young people who wanted to have those magical powers. They didn't want to be a muggle. They wanted to be a wizard. And, you know, Barnes & Noble had sections. They had a whole Harry Potter section, I remember, in some of these stores, including sections on how to cast spells, how to get your witch on, so to speak, and how to learn how to be a wizard, that kind of thing, because there's some kids who really want that. So not to put too fine a point on it, but I think this is an area where people, young kids especially, are going to be further prodded in a very subtle way in that direction. And I'll just leave it at this. This is not true confessions, but for what it's worth, I remember, to your point that you were making a moment ago, Cyrus, about when you're 13, I remember, even, you know, 12, 13 years old, certain songs, I mean, totally fine song, nothing wrong with the song itself, but they would make me feel funny feelings that I didn't understand. And I look back later and I realized that there was, you know, the song or the words of the song, they were kind of stirring up in me feelings of like attraction for girls, but I didn't understand what those feelings were. And later on, I understood what they were because I grew into maturity and I could process these things. But this is normal for children at even much younger ages, where whether it's music or visuals, it has an effect on them. And that's why the parents and teachers and counselors and doctors and others need to be doing their best to try to guide these young people so that they won't get swept away. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Barbara in Kendall, Florida. Good morning, Barbara.
Yes, good morning. I just want to encourage people to go to your local Target, Walmart. I went to my Target at the children's book section, because I have a small child, and I was horrified to see so many books on pride, pro-gay, and some books were so explicitly suggestive of sodomy and child abuse that I complained to the manager, and thank God, last time I went, those books weren't there. But I think parents need to be aware that this is being pushed, and there are many books that go to Target and check out. I'm not even going to mention the names, but some were so shockingly explicit about sexuality, gay sexuality.
What did you tell the manager, Barbara? What did you tell him or her?
Well, Yes, I took those books that are the most explicit and even on the cover suggestive of child sexual abuse, and a fixation on their behinds. And I told them, this is child abuse. You are promoting pedophilia right here in these books, and they need to be removed. And so the lady said, okay, I grabbed the whole stack and series, and I threw it into her cart, which was a lady working there. I talked to the man. The week following when I came back, those books weren't there.
Good for you.
So I think if she has any decency, she needs, and also to be aware with Barnes & Noble. I walked into Barnes & Noble. I'm horrified. The whole main aisle was filled with occult books, explicitly satanic books, on the main aisle where all the children walk in. And in fact, strangely enough, I think it's a sign from God to follow this intuition. They were playing literally demonic music being brought. A song was saying, if you want a friend, you know, be with the devil. I was horrified. I don't walk in that store anymore. So just be aware. You need to check out the children's section.
Thank you, Barbara. That sounds grim. And I knew it was bad. I just haven't been in a Target for some time now. But I will, next time I go into a Target, I'll go to the books section and have a look and see what's there. I'm glad you did what you did. I really am. That reminds me briefly of something that my dad did when I was about that age. I guess I was about 12 years old, 13 years old. We had a family custom after Mass on Sundays to stop at the donut store and get a big pink box of donuts and bring them home and enjoy. So one place that we would go to was a delicatessen that also had donuts. And the delicatessen was called La Vicios. It was an Italian name, La Vicios, I think it was called. And I'm just trying to remember all the specifics here. One Sunday we went there and I went in with my dad, and I think my younger sister did too. And so we were there to help him pick out the donuts. And as we walked by, he noticed that there was a new magazine rack there that had porn in it. And it wasn't there before, but the owner of the store had had taken this on as part of his new product line. My dad had a conniption fit. And he told me, and my sister says, don't walk by here. Don't look at this. And, go over there by the front. So he walked up to the front counter where the cash register was. And I was there. I watched the whole thing. And my dad lit this guy up. He said, you're the owner, right? Yeah. He says, why do you have those magazines over there? And my dad was raising his voice. And he says, well, because I sell them. What's it to you? He said, well, I don't want my kids coming in here, and I don't want to see those things. And for that matter, what about all the other people who are coming in here? What about kids who come in here? You're going to put those magazines out there where they can see them? He says, this is outrageous. And the guy said, well, tough luck. So he was pushing back. My dad was lighting this guy up and he was trying to, stand up to him. And he said, tough luck. This is my store and I'll sell what I want. And my dad, I remember watching him thinking, go, Dad. Because he said, okay, fine, but this is my money and these are my kids and we'll never come back in here again. And by the way, I'm going to tell everyone I know, all of my friends, all of my coworkers, everyone I know, I'm going to tell them, don't come into this store because they sell pornographic magazines. And then my dad, come on, kids, let's go. So we walked out, we got in the car, no donuts that day. Or maybe we went to a different place, I don't know. But here's the happy ending. A few months later, that store no longer carried pornography. And the reason was my dad made good on his word. He told everybody. He told everybody in the parish. Because this was a place that, in the area. I grew up in Mission Viejo in Orange County. So this was a place where, a lot of people would go. And my dad beat this guy at his own game. And I think it was just the pressure of so many people going in there and complaining about it. And I've got kids, and why do you have these magazines here? So eventually it took on a life of its own. It was no longer just my dad, but he sure was a catalyst for that, and those magazines were gone.
Game over, man. Game over.
That's right. That's right. So thanks, Dad. That was a great example to your impressionable young son. I'm glad you did that. I'll be back with more of your phone calls right after this quick timeout.
I'm Batman.
Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
I posted on Twitter last night. I said, my friend Drew Mariani and I are getting together for dinner, a glass of red wine, and a long conversation Friday evening. Any messages you'd like me to pass along, Patrick Madrid Show listeners? So if you'd like to send me a message you'd like me to pass along to Drew when we have dinner on Friday, put it there on my Twitter feed. To the phones. Let's go to Andrew now, listening in San Diego. Hello, Andrew.
Good to hear from you guys. Yeah. You were talking earlier about kids being sexualized so young. And I wanted to ask about, you know, our human history, we've had 12-year-old kings and queens. Mm-hmm. So is it a big deal to say, oh, they're 12 years old, 13, we can't let them know about sexuality or human intercourse?
So you're talking about like actual royalty, the king of France or the king of England who ascended to the throne as a boy. Is that what you mean?
Yes. So I mean that humans, once we're 12, 13, we are capable of being fully mature and adult about things and making sound decisions.
Well, see, that's where you and I part company, because in those instances, at least the ones that I read about in history class and such, they were children who were named as the monarch, but they had a regent who acted on their behalf. And the younger the child, the more hands-on the regent was. So the regent would be making decisions on behalf of that underage child. But people are people are people, and a 12-year-old in 1500 has the same maturity level as a 12-year-old today. Now, external factors notwithstanding, human nature is the same regardless of the era. So I'm not aware of any brilliant boy kings who had mature decisions at the age of 12. They had to grow into that. Even though they may have held the crown legally, they didn't typically exercise that authority because the regent would do that for them. And eventually, when they grew old enough, then they would be able to assume those powers. So,
well, that makes sense. I mean, every king needs someone to enact his will. He's not able to go and do the thing he needs to do. He has to stay in the throne room. But yes, I understand what you're trying to say. It's just humans were able to mature and come to sexual maturity pretty young. I know some girls are having their periods at 10 years old, and that's biology allowing them to have kids.
Actually,
so I think we should be preparing them for that, because once they're in that level. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
No, it's okay. I've heard about that, and some of the things that I've discovered is that that's not normal. It's certainly not a typical age for a girl to start experiencing that. And I've read some things that indicate that there may be some influence from, for example, external sources like the hormones from the contraceptive pills that get into the water, they get into the drinking water, the groundwater. Now, I don't have the scientific information in front of me to quote it to you, but I would say that that is an anomaly. Those are outliers. That's not normal. It's not typical for a 10-year-old girl. So in any case, I guess I understand what you're saying. I don't know how much bearing kings and queens have on this topic, because after all, we don't have that system anymore. But by and large, kids can't operate at that level typically. Maybe a few can because they're prodigies. But generally, kids at that age, they're so unprepared for it. And so whether it's ruling a country or getting married, they're not ready for it yet. Anyway, thank you, Andrew. I appreciate it. Let's go to Sheila, in Bella Vista, Arkansas. Hi, Sheila.
Hey, Patrick. It's a privilege to talk with you. I just wanted to make the comment. I'm a longtime sidewalk advocate and counselor out in front of the Planned Parenthood abortion centers, and praise God, the one here up in Northwest Arkansas closed a couple of years ago. So we are abortion center free. They're trying to open up in another place, but so far they haven't been successful. But anyway, about 6 months or so before they close, we noticed that there was a real change developing in the clientele at the Planned Parenthood.
Okay.
And this guy came walking up to me, big smile on his face. I'm pro-life. And when he got close to me, I realized he had facial hair, but wasn't wearing a bra. And I realized it was a woman. And I didn't know what to say. He said, Planned Parenthood, we have to keep them around because they're the only ones that can help me become who I truly am. And I said, well, why are you pro-life? And he said, all life has value. I said, well, I certainly agree with that. But I was at a loss. You know, I mean, I've had lots of training in sidewalk advocacy for young women to get them to go to the pregnancy care centers, but to know what to say to someone who's allegedly transitioning. And I guess I'm calling just because if any of your listeners are regular sidewalk advocates or prayer warriors out in front of the Planned Parenthood, that we need to be trained on how to witness to this clientele too, because Planned Parenthood, I understand, is like the largest purchaser of testosterone in the country. And they are fast developing the business of transitioning. And if you think they're an abortion center, that evil empire is expanding into new forms of evil. So,
yeah. So it's like, would you like fries with that? You know, we specialize in abortion, but would you like fries with that? Because we have other things we can sell you now.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Well, I'm so happy that you're doing what you're doing, Sheila. Thank you for being a public witness for this.
You. Well, thank you for all your support. And I just, again, highly recommend the book. And I've learned so much. I wish I would have had that knowledge back then. I would have been able to be a better witness. But we'll be prepared.
I'm sure you did just fine.
Well, thank you for your time. And thanks for all you do.
Thank you. I appreciate your phone call. How about Andre now, listening in Hanford, California? Good morning, Andre.
Good morning, Patrick. So I have heard on this program and other high-quality Catholic podcasts and radio shows and videos and things like that, how it's a sin to disobey your conscience. And even so, when perhaps your conscience is wrong, like to go against what you truly, your gut, your conscience is telling you is right, to go against that is wrong. So I just want you to explain that a little bit more to me, please, so I can have a deeper understanding.
Sure.
I'm going to throw out a scenario. Like, say you have a heretic, you know, who's just super committed to these erroneous beliefs, goes throughout the countryside telling everyone to believe these things that are wrong. And then, you know, later maybe towards his life, he recants because of pressure for excommunication threat or something like that. And but he still really believes these things, but he's going against his conscience in order to get to not be excommunicated or something like that. That's a good thing that he's recanting, but is it also a bad thing because he's going against his conscience? I need help understanding this.
Yeah, sure. This is a very important topic. So your conscience is ultimately what you have to obey, because the conscience is it's the operation of your soul that not only warns you about something that is wrong, immoral, before you do it, but also reminds you of something that you've done that was wrong or immoral. It could also be a sin of omission. So to answer your question, let me quote from the Catechism of the Catholic Church that speaks to this issue. So this is paragraph 1782. Man has the right to act in conscience and in freedom so as personally to make moral decisions. He must not be forced to act contrary to his conscience, nor must he be prevented from acting according to his conscience, especially in religious matters. Paragraph 1778. Conscience is a judgment of reason whereby the human person recognizes the moral quality of a concrete act that he is going to perform, is in the process of performing, or has already completed. In all he says and does, man is obliged to follow faithfully what he knows to be just and right. It is by the judgment of his conscience that man perceives and recognizes the prescriptions of the divine law. And the subtext to this paragraph says, conscience is a law of the mind, yet Christians would not grant that it is nothing more. It is not a dictate nor conveyed the notion of responsibility. It's of duty. Conscience is a messenger of him who both in nature and in grace speaks to us behind a veil and teaches and rules us by his representatives. Conscience is the aboriginal vicar of Christ. Now, the last section deals with more specifically with your question about what about somebody who has an erroneous conscience. So starting in paragraph 1790, a human being must always obey the certain judgment of his conscience. If he were deliberately to act against it, he would condemn himself. Yet it can happen that moral conscience remains in ignorance and makes erroneous judgments about acts to be performed or already committed. This ignorance can often be imputed to personal responsibility. This is the case when a man takes a little trouble to find out what is true and good, takes little trouble to find out what is true and good, or when conscience is by degrees almost blinded through the habit of committing sin. In such cases, the person is culpable for the evil he commits. Ignorance of Christ and his gospel, bad example given by others, enslavement to one's passions, assertion of a mistaken notion of autonomy of conscience, rejection of the church's authority and her teaching, lack of conversion and of charity, these can be at the source of errors of judgment in moral conduct. On the contrary, if the ignorance is invincible, or the moral subject is not responsible for his erroneous judgment, the evil committed by the person cannot be imputed to him. It remains no less an evil, a privation, a disorder. One must therefore work to correct the errors of moral conscience. And then the last paragraph says, a good and pure conscience is enlightened by true faith, for charity proceeds at the same time from a pure heart and a good conscience and sincere faith. The more a correct conscience prevails, the more do persons and groups turn aside from blind choice and try to be guided by objective standards of moral conduct. So I think it's important to get all of that out there, and then I'll just simply tag this on. If the person is preaching heresy, so that was the example you gave. So he's preaching or saying or holding, believing in a heresy. And the church says that's wrong. And he says, well, I really do believe this. And the church says, yeah, but that's wrong. I would argue that he is culpable for holding the heretical view, even just because his rightly formed conscience is hearing from one of those sources, one of those objectively authoritative sources to help guide a conscience and to form a conscience, and he's rejecting that voice. So it would be tantamount to him saying, on the one hand, well, I really do believe this is true. Take Martin Luther with his error of justification by faith alone. He really believed that. And the church says, no, that's not true. So in his case, there was a kind of willful rejection of an authoritative voice that's there to help inform his conscience. And so, you know, if in the case that you're giving me, if somebody's excommunicated and later on he says, you know what, I don't want to die excommunicated, I will give in and recant and I'll abjure this heresy, even though internally he says, I still believe it, he's not doing a bad thing and he's not really disobeying his conscience. He's obeying an informed conscience that now corrected, you know, his inclination, his desire to hold on to that earlier view. He realizes that even though it may appeal to him more, even though he's more drawn to it, even though he thinks that it, you know, is the way he should go, he's recognizing the authority of this voice of the church, which is ultimately the voice of Christ, which is correcting that malformed conscience. What do you think?
Very good. Very good. I really appreciate that response. It is, I mean, you kind of really think about it. Sometimes you can go in circles a little bit, but I think it was a very good response.
I appreciate that. And the catechism is at the ready, of course, if you want to go back and reread those sections. One thing I will say, and thank you for the call, Andre. One thing I will say is that many people, and perhaps through no fault of their own, just because they were never really taught about these things, they confuse conscience with desire or conscience with inclination. Or conscience with attraction. So you may be attracted to something and then say to yourself, well, in conscience, I feel that I should be able to do this. That's not your conscience. That's not your conscience speaking to you. That's an appetite, perhaps. That's an attraction. We all have those, don't we? But your conscience is what evaluates the moral content or the moral weight of an action. A human action, which involves your intention, it involves the circumstances, and it involves the act itself. It has to have some moral content in order to be a human act. And when you're thinking about something, remember that it would be maybe the equivalent of saying, I would really like to have a second big piece of cake for dessert. And your conscience is saying, well, you already had a meal, you already had a piece of cake, and it's not healthy for you to have another piece of cake, so you really shouldn't have another piece of cake. Exercise some self-control. So your conscience is saying that to you, but your body is saying, but I want a piece of cake. That cake tasted great, so I want some more cake. So that's not your conscience that's urging you to go for another piece of cake. That's your appetite, your desire, your cupidity, which is a very good word for topics like this. Cupidity is that sometimes violent desire for something that you want. You want to enjoy it. And our cupidity can get the better of us. And just remember, when you're stopping and thinking about this, that's not your conscience. Your conscience is going to say, you know what? Don't have the second piece of cake. I'll be right back with the third hour of our 3-hour extravaganza known as the Patrick Madrid Show right after this.